see. Mr. Craven. Hey, Bill. Don't let Mr. Shookit try to distract you.
I plead guilty to starting that.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to call the meeting to order of the Ocean Protection Council and note who is present. We have a quorum. I need to announce that somewhere around 11:30, if this meeting is still going on, I need to run out of here and start the process of catching a flight. So if the meeting is still going, we will continue, but I'm going to do my best, because I potentially am the quorum walking out, to make sure that if there's any action items, we have acted on them by 11:30. So I ask for everybody's discipline in their comments, and if it looks like discipline is not being exercised, I might reorder items to make sure that action items are within that period of time. And just additionally, a few opening comments. Obviously, it just sort of goes without saying, but I feel obligated to acknowledge that Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast has reopened a lot of issues on the national front that are issues that are in front of the Ocean Protection Council. And as much of a tragedy as that storm was, it has moved to the front again. Some of the very issues we're talking about sea level rise and extreme events, and the governor's conference almost a year ago on extreme events turns out to be very prescient for what the country is thinking about right now. And even given some of the things that will be discussed later today at this meeting, that really sets the table in a way that people are paying attention. And I also want to acknowledge the science advisory group that I met with a couple of weeks ago, and we will hear a little about it, but it was a day-long meeting on ocean acidification. And I went in part to highlight its priority and that we really valued their work and what they were undertaking, because just in the overall context of the Ocean Protection Council, it's my view that we need to highlight the four or five things that are the major things that we can focus on and influence people on and call attention to, and acidification is clearly one. And it has been in the news in the last 2 days because of the state of Washington and the fact that the governor of Washington just took a number of measures and did a focus on it. And I think all of us are looking at that and trying to see what's in that package and see to what extent it relates to us. And then additionally, since we last met, there was this minor national election. And I think the fact that the election nationally came out the way it did means that the national ocean policy, as we have known it, will continue to be implemented and continue to be a focus. And irrespective of whatever the partisanship is of that race, the fact that the national ocean policy will continue is a good thing for all of us, and I know our staff will continue to engage on that issue. And I didn't know lastly, under opening comments, Secretary Rodriguez had anything that he wanted to say about the AB 32 carbon auction, but it obviously is something that might have an impact on oceans. But that completes my opening comments, and I was going to ask if any other members had anything they wanted to say. Mr. Rodriguez.
Well, thank you. I'll just note, following up on your comments, that clearly one of the ways we address extreme events is by making sure that we do what we can to minimize climate change and address the problems that are created by climate change. And so it's an important step in California's effort to deal with climate change. We, since our last meeting, did have our first auction under the cap and trade program under AB 32. I know there was a lot of press surrounding it, and I know that a lot of people have been following the progress of the cap and trade program. I just want to say that, one, I think it was a very, very important milestone for us to have the first auction. Second, we were very pleased with the way the auction went, because I think that the prices that were set for the price of carbon were reasonable, you know, we will see how this all progresses in future auctions. But what's important is that we establish a price for carbon, that we got the program up and running, that we signaled our intent to go forward and to address climate change here in California. So I think it was a very, very important moment in the implementation of AB 32. I know that there was some concern expressed about the fact that not as much money as some folks might have expected came in terms of purchases of 2015 vintage allowances. But you know, let me remind folks that our real goal here is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's always been our goal. Certainly, we can use additional revenues for programs that can help us to achieve that goal. But we were very pleased with the way that the auction went, we're looking forward to seeing what happens with the next auction in February. So I think it's an important time in California, because we're making really progress in a lot of significant programs here, including the cap and trade program.
Thank you. That was a great report. Do any other members, and I should acknowledge that Bill Craven is here for Senator Pavley and Cody Naylor is here for Assembly Member Atkins, and that Alan Gordon is here for the State Controller. Any other announcements?
No.
Great. Then we'll move to item number 2, which is the report from the Executive Director.
Yes, which I would recommend other people do as well. Thank you so much. I have to note that I was trained by a board where the executive director's report came last on the meeting agenda, and so by that point nobody was paying any attention. I'm mindful of the honor of talking first or almost first at the meeting, but we'll be brief. What I wanted to do is pick up on three threads from last month's meeting. First is to acknowledge the Secretary's comments on ocean acidification, and I will definitely pass that off to Skyly, who will be talking about that in her report. I wanted to talk a little bit about sea level rise as follow-up to the presentation that we gave you on the NRC report. There have been two workshops, one in California, and then there'll be one in Oregon on sea level rise, to bring together the state folks who work on the issue to move that issue forward and to spread the news, if you will. We're keenly aware that we need to do more workshops and more work with local folks, and that thread will continue then in today's meeting with the item before you on grants to local agencies for dealing with sea level rise. The other item is to let you know that there is going to be some money from the Japanese government coming to work on the tsunami debris. That's still a work in progress, but there'll be money for each of the states on the West Coast coming through NOAA that will be managed by CalEMA, but that will be probably announced, I would imagine, in the next month or so. Then there are a couple of things that were put forward, that have come forward, I wanted to mention since the written report was completed. One is that we are undertaking with NOAA and the shellfish industry a shellfish initiative, and our first initial kickoff meeting is probably going to be scheduled in January. And then on the happy news, we will be able to hire a number of Sea Grant fellows. We rely on our Sea Grant fellows to do a lot of the work for Ocean Protection Council, and we also house some of them with other agencies to help facilitate our communication. And so several of the Sea Grant fellows from last class have gotten hired by those agencies, which is really great. And then we're going to be hiring in a new group who will start probably in February. So pretty exciting. A lot of good things moving ahead. And thank you for your time.
And just one additional thing before any possible questions, and that is there was potential action here on the OPC meeting schedule for 2013. It's included, and all I was going to say is I would suggest we not take action, but that if anybody has any updates or concerns or conflicts, they just email the staff in the next week, and then we'll finalize a schedule. That's our goal, and let people know.
That's why you're the chair.
Any questions of the executive director?
Ms. Geraldine. I just had one question. The workshop on December 19th, which is the Sea Level Rise workshop, where's that going to be? It was mentioned in your report. Oh, in Costa Mesa? Okay. I'd love to get information on, you know, when and where. That'd be great. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for asking that. We'll move to item number three, the report from the science advisor, Skyway.
Hi, good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the council. And in the interest of getting you on your airplane, I'm going to keep this very brief. But as mentioned, the science advisory team did meet on the 19th of November to undertake the charge that the council asked of it, which is to think through the best way to empanel experts on ocean acidification to be responsive to California's information needs on this, you know, obviously very important emerging issue. And I also really want to extend on behalf of the scientists there and everybody there, thank you for opening the meeting. And you served the purpose of energizing it and making it exciting. So it was very, very exciting to have you there. At that meeting, we heard from scientists who participated in Washington State's effort. And as you mentioned just this week, that report, that big report came out, so I know what I'm doing this weekend. And we also heard from decision makers, US EPA and California's own Water Board, to begin to think through with the scientists, what experts we want on this panel and how we can be most responsive and agile to California. And it's also our goal to learn from what Washington did and take them on as partners in this and stand on their shoulders. They've done a terrific amount of heavy lifting, and I expect that the panel's first objective will be to see how much of that report translates to California. Well, I expect I'll be reporting back on that probably in the spring with with actual products. So everybody is excited to get underway, and that'll be the charge for December. Secondly, with the Ocean Protection Council staff, the Ocean Science Trust Monitoring Enterprise team has been on the North Coast, and we're doing the due diligence that we always do in advance of the release of an RFP. This one will be for baseline characterization, both socioeconomic and ecological information of that region as the MPAs become legal up there. And we've taken on additional steps with the North Coast to make certain that we are capturing the best local and tribal knowledge of that region. There are a lot of unique attributes, and we want to be incredibly thorough in how we get that information and incorporate it into the development of that RFP. So that work is underway and going very well. And then finally, by way of reminder, on the 27th of February through March 1st is in Monterey, the State of the Central Coast Symposium, and this is our first opportunity to review the results of baseline socioeconomic and ecological MPA monitoring information, and it's also an opportunity to think through governance structures and enforcing enforcement opportunities and so forth, and that's going to be a gathering of obviously scientists, but also decision makers and stakeholders. So we've had a terrific response to this symposium. In fact, folks internationally are coming. It's not just for the Central Coast and not just for California, but there's a lot of interested folks that are going to be descending on Monterey for that. And I encourage people to go to the website, which they can find from Googling the State of the Central Coast and registering. So that's all I have for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Then we're going to move to item number four on sea level rise. And in a second, I'm going to ask Kat to introduce this item. But I was just going to mention that that obviously climate change adaptation is a major priority for the OPC. And we did receive a briefing at the last meeting from about the recently released National Research Council report on that developed a specific or West Coast specific data. But I just wanted to mention that this was a priority in the 2009 adaptation strategy that was released through the Resources Agency, and we are currently in the process of updating that and taking it to the next level. And I know that the OPC staff is working with people that are in the room and from other agencies to work on the outcome of that on this very issue. So with that acknowledgement, I'll turn it over to you to introduce the item.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And I'd like to introduce Mary Small, who has been working on this issue for both OPC and the Conservancy. It's, you know, one of those, she turns her hat like this. And we're also very honored to have with us, you know, that Sam is going to give a presentation as well as Charles Lester. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Mary.
Great, thank you. Is this one on? So staff is recommending approval of a grant program to fund both local vulnerability assessments and updates to local coastal programs to do a competitive grant round to provide grants to fund that. And if we're given the authorization today, we will come back to the council in the spring with specific grant criteria and the outline of the program, and then we'll go through a selection process and bring the actual grants back to the council again, probably next fall. I think that's sort of a reasonable program. As the Secretary alluded, this is a need that has been long identified, and it's a natural extension of the work that the OPC has been doing on sea level rise. A recent study that USC did on coastal climate adaptation needs assessment found that there was actually a great deal of understanding of the issue by local governments in California, but there was a really serious need for resources to help them figure out what the specific vulnerabilities are and how to develop plans that respond to them. The second thing I think I wanted to just mention briefly is that I think this is a really exciting partnership between three agencies. As Kat said, I'm here a little bit on behalf of the OPC and the Coastal Conservancy, but I want to acknowledge that both the Coastal Conservancy and the Coastal Commission are providing their staff time as an in-kind support to this grant program, and we envision that it will require a lot of working together to come up with meaningful plans that actually can be implemented, especially under the Coastal Act, which is the entire point. And so with that, I just want to thank the Coastal Commission staff who have been helping us think this through, and I will turn it over to Charles Lester, who is director of the Coastal Commission.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Council. I'm very happy to be here today to support this proposal. In California, our coastal program has a 40-year history of dealing with coastal erosion and shoreline management issues, but I believe that climate change and sea level rise is the single most important challenge that we face going forward in the coming decades. All of the issues that we've been dealing with, erosion, flooding, how to protect existing development, how to protect our beaches, all of those are going to be exacerbated, the trends accelerated by sea level rise, and we need to invest in this type of effort to update our local ability to adapt. As you've heard, local coastal programs are the central planning and regulatory tool in our coastal zone for doing this kind of work, and we do need to invest in our capacity to update those plans, to provide for adaptation, to provide for protection of infrastructure, provide for protection of our beaches and recreational resources, which are going to be squeezed by sea level rise and existing development. So this is, I believe, a critically important task for us to do. The Coastal Commission has been active in the last 5 or 6 years with the state coordinated efforts on this issue. I want to acknowledge our Chief Deputy, Susan Hanch, who's here today. She's been our point working with the COCAT and helping us provide our input into policy development and sea level rise issues along the way. We intend to keep doing that. We are also actively working with our commission and local partners on moving sea level rise policy forward through the LCP planning process and coastal development. We anticipate releasing some draft sea level rise guidance for local governments and also project applicants within the next month or so. We are also having a workshop in a couple weeks at our December meeting with local governments, and I'll turn to that again in a minute. But one of the things that we're doing as an add-on to that workshop is having Gary Griggs come and give us a collective presentation on the summary of the NRC report and the status of thinking about sea level rise. So we are trying to bring some of that expertise to a shared hearing with local government. And that's the last thing I wanted to mention is that we've been spending a lot of time focusing on our capacity to work well with local governments and improve the LCP process and our ability to bring LCP updates forward. We've had a lot of issues raised about the lack of staff capacity at the Coastal Commission in order to do that kind of work. While we wholeheartedly support this effort and this investment is needed, I do want to highlight that lack of capacity with the Coastal Commission as well, and we are going to do our best to support this kind of work, but we are also seeking every other source of funding we can to help us bring forward more LCP updates on this question. So those are the remarks I wanted to make, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and also the opportunity to work with the Conservancy and OPC on developing the program as we go along the way. So, thank you.
I have a quick question. In addition to the fact that you just almost put me back into being budget chair again, the way you talked about your capacity, which obviously leads to financial resources. The question I had is, you said in the normal order of the local coastal plan process, and is it the expectation that when any coastal government updates their general plan, they will update their local coastal plan, and that in effect, if we're trying to get them through the local coastal plans to address sea level rise or coastal erosion, that basically it goes in the sequence of whenever somebody's doing their general plan. So if that's a rolling group of people over 10 years, that's how we'll see this play out when people update the local coastal plans?
I think it will be a little bit driven by the flow of events at the local level. So we have 76 local governments. About 85% of the coastal zone is under a certified plan. Some local governments are still working on their initial LCP. That's another story.
I'm really familiar with that, and yeah. I am really familiar when you refused to be the planning commission for the city of Carmel, and once you did that moratorium, they finally adopted a plan.
That's right. The dynamics are in play in a couple of places still. So a lot of LCPs have been in place for 20-plus years. They need to be updated on all kinds of issues. So there's a natural local interest in updating LCPs. When those updates come forward, we encourage and we'll hope that they include climate change and sea level rise issues. And I think there's a local interest in doing that, independent of what the Coastal Commission and the OPC are trying to do for the state. So it will be driven by the timing and submittal of plans and amendments by local governments. It will depend on where they are with updates, but it will also, I think, be targeted so that we will see specific updates on this issue because they want to do this kind of thing. And so it won't be a complete general plan overhaul, LCP overhaul, but rather a targeted sea level rise update. And I know from the work we've been doing with our local government working group that this issue is very, very much on their radar. But as was mentioned, there's a lack of capacity, not just funding, but the knowledge and the information and how to do this. And so we see ourselves in that pivotal position at the statewide level to bring that kind of information to all of the local governments so that these LCPs are able to share that information. And I think one of the things in the report is targeting grant proposals that could potentially become models and have transferability across the state, and I think that would be a really important thing to look at.
Well,
as the grants come forward.
I really appreciate your answer, and in part it was to educate some of the stakeholders as to what the timing might be, but there's a nuance that affects this agenda item, and the nuance is that if you can fund a local ability to do it, it is different than if the legislature enacts it and requires it, and it becomes a mandate, and then there's a cost that affects the ability to enact it at the state level. And so if you have the ability through grants to do it, or through information that's available in a coordinated way to everybody so that everybody doesn't have to hire their individual consultant on certain things, it gets around what is a legislative or legal impediment to enacting a requirement to do it. And so that is sort of an important thing to take into account in this. And then it means we have to accept what the rolling schedule is or how people engage, because they're not necessarily being required to do it on a certain date through a law. And that's just a tough balance.
It is, but I think that is an important reality to recognize, that we need the incentives. I do believe that if the funding is available, made available, and we provide technical support and, you know, the capacity that we can, that they will happen. It will just happen over time.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Lester? Mr. Craven.
Thank you. Is this working? Okay. Just a quick question. I'm not sure this is for you, Charles, or for Mary. The way I read this, by the way, I have to say I'm strongly in support of this. This has been a big issue for a long time. But are the grants going to result in a vulnerability assessment and an updated local coastal plan, or?
I think probably or, and that's really reflecting the fact that different communities are in different places in terms of their understanding of what the issues and the risks are. And the answer, I think, is or, that we would include both technical studies of vulnerabilities and, for those communities that are ready to start actually developing adaptation plans, and as Charles said, are ready to undertake the full LCP updates, you know, we would like to push some to go that far. But recognizing that different communities along the coast are in different places, we wanted to sort of be able to help move everybody forward.
Okay, and my second and last question is, I appreciated the way that you phrased that the staff work from both the Conservancy and the Commission would be an in-kind contribution to this grand effort. And while I think that's laudatory, I just wonder if any consideration has been given or not to providing some staff support in these grants for this work. And I recognize that would diminish the amount of funding that's available, but on the other hand, it would, I guess, enhance the work product. And there's a balance there, and I just wonder if how much thought has been given to that question.
Putting my Coastal Conservancy hat on, I think, as you know, I'm developing the 10-year budget for how the Coastal Conservancy will survive. I can tell you that as Charles said, where the Commission is facing severe capacity issues, the Coastal Conservancy is also facing very, very dire budget situations. So those agencies, I think, both would welcome that assistance. And I think that, as you say, the product would be better to the extent that the agencies can really engage and provide detailed technical assistance. I think that would be valuable. I think it's really a policy question for the council as to how you want to use the resources that we have.
Okay.
Could I just add on that question? You know, the idea of the LCPs is that the shared management, and the commission reviews, works with local government and reviews and approves those LCPs to make sure they're consistent with state law. The vision really is, and what we're getting a lot of push on from local governments, is that we need to spend more time earlier in the process developing LCPs, and that's the capacity that I'm really concerned about. That's the primary focus of this workshop in 2 weeks. We have about 70 LCP amendments pending right now that are not on climate change and sea level rise. They're on all kinds of things. So what I meant by this will add more work, we'll get more LCP amendments into that pot, but it's not like we have an additional capacity to do them quickly and immediately or better and faster. We need that across the board. And so to the extent we can invest in joint planning resources, local government needs the resources for sure. That's going to make it work more effectively.
Thank you. Any other? Mr. Rodriguez.
I'm going to assume that there are certain areas on the coast for which sea level rise is more of an issue than other sections of the coast. So how are we going to make sure that we have a broad range of grants, grant applications that really reflect those areas of the coast where we as a state would like to see the most work?
Maybe Sam wants to add detail, but I know we're going to work together on grant criteria.
I think
that segues nicely to what I
was. Well, I was just going to say Sam was the next one up, so I think you should answer the question and then move into your next thing. Okay. But I was going to make one brief comment because there was a helpful thing in the middle there that we are being webcast, and unless you speak to the into the microphone, the people watching the webcast just see lips moving and don't hear a thing. So throughout the meeting, it's very helpful to speak directly into the mic.
So our desire is to structure the RFP in such a way and the, you know, the criteria that we'll use to grade the proposals that we get essentially so that we get a variety of different sizes of local governments, cities, counties, bigger, smaller, and that it is distributed geographically around the state in a way that lets us look at people that have different kinds of issues. You know, the issues in Crescent City or in Humboldt Bay are quite different than they are at Newport Beach, for instance. They both have issues, but it's, you know, it's different because of geography, population, and so on. So we want to set this up so that we get a variety of different kinds of communities involved, which will then give us the knowledge base going forward in the future. Because, of course, eventually we want all the communities to have their LCPs be updated and to have done vulnerability assessments.
So let me just quickly ask Mr. Rodriguez's question in a different way, which is that if you're in the lost coast of Mendocino, the big issue is whether the Roosevelt elk know to seek higher ground over time. If you're Newport Beach, it is houses and people and livelihoods and businesses. How do you make sure the places that are most vulnerable are targeted in this?
There are some very vulnerable places on the North Coast and for whom the impact of climate change, because their economies are relatively smaller and more coastal-oriented, will be much greater. There are also places like, the Port of Los Angeles. I don't know why I picked that one. It just came to mind. It just popped into my head.
You're very concerned that the picket lines are above sea level.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. That's right. You don't want the protesters to be, you know, drowned out there, right? Actually the most heavily impacted coastal county in the state in terms of economic value at risk is Orange County, according to the study that this body funded, I think, 3 years ago now. And that's because they have relatively more gently sloping down to the ocean kind of terrain. A lot of LA County is actually up on bluffs. So we want to be thoughtful about how we pick and choose to make sure that we cover the waterfront, so to speak. So anyway, the Coastal Conservancy is very excited to be partnering in this. As you probably know, SB 1066, signed by the governor, directs the Conservancy to engage in these kinds of activities, among others. We have funded a few vulnerability assessments in Humboldt Bay and Monterey Bay. Those are both ongoing right now. We're hopeful that this will build on those efforts in those places. The Conservancy has also funded some managed retreat in a few places around the coast in Ventura County and in San Mateo, coastal San Mateo County. And we're also doing some, we're piloting right now some living shoreline experiments in the bay to see if oyster beds and eelgrass beds can actually attenuate wave energy. We and the Coastal Commission have a preference for green approaches to coastal protection, and I'm sure that we'll be trying to encourage that with the local governments that we work with. One last thing I wanted to say, well, actually two last things I wanted to say. I'm glad that the Secretary started with Hurricane Sandy. I have a lot of family in New York and New Jersey. My daughter, my mother, my brother, my father-in-law, they were all affected. It was pretty horrific. It got me thinking about what we need to do in our, particularly in our populated areas, to protect against what happened there. The entrances, for instance, to the BART system in the Bay Area are quite vulnerable to exactly what happened in New York. So it really drove it home for me that we need to get going on actually preparing our communities for what we know is going to happen. And along those lines, there is growing interest in Congress in some kind of emergency appropriations bill for Hurricane Sandy, and we are keeping an eye on that in case there's any opportunity to get some funding for preparation here in California. And if you approve this, I think that we'll be able to use this as a potential match for anything that we might be able to get down the road from the federal government. So, thank you.
I have a question, but let me first just say that we have five people that want to speak on this, and if they just would start to get ready, because whenever we're done with questions, we will move to it. The first one is Michael McCormick, and the person that will be on deck second will be Sean Bothwell. My question is I strongly support this, and actually we should talk about if there is any additional money, whether it's a match or offsets or how that happens over time, because we need to be agile in how this all fits together financially. But my question is if we approve this today, which I hope after discussion we will, how will we be kept abreast of the progress in a way that we know on a regular basis, who's stepping up to respond, who isn't, whether it's being effective, whether there's a different way to do it that we've learned as it starts to roll. How will we have some kind of iterative process to measure the outcome of this?
So we will come back to you, hopefully, at your March meeting with the RFP and the criteria and so on for you to approve. And then we'll put it out, and then we will come back to you with a set of recommended projects along with here's how many we got and here's why we picked the ones that we picked. And then once we get them rolling, there's a lot of different ways that we can engage you in the work as it happens, and ranging from formal presentations here, as we learn things, to invitations to workshops in the places where the activities are happening, to all of these will produce actual written documents which we can make available to you, and then hopefully at least in some cases the outcome of the work leads to actual adaptive action on the ground, and we should be able to keep you appraised of that as it happens, although that's a few years, at least a few years out.
Well, I think one of the things I was thinking of when you were talking is I have been to Orange County, I think it's twice in the last 4 or 5 months, and in each case, I'm either meeting with people about or visiting about things that are very related, whether or not the link has been made.
Right.
If I'm visiting their recycling plant, which I did a few weeks ago, that is in part doing underground injection to fight sea water intrusion into their water table. It's very much, and I went out on the marine protected areas that is very much there. Boating and Waterways has certain grants to some of the ports there and some of the marinas that very much relates. And so if there's planning going on, that's something that we should reflect in some of the activities of the different agencies. It is really helpful to have the feedback in a way that the feedback can work, at least in my sphere, and I suspect in everybody else's here. There are different ways that it does, and we can figure out how to do that, because I know I had this meeting that was as secretary, but was because the hometown people wanted it because of the boardwalk nearly washing away in Santa Cruz due to a river rerouting. And I sort of stopped the whole meeting by asking how they expected this to deal with extreme events coming the other way and storms and sea level rise. And it just sort of stopped the meeting in a way that they were only thinking of water coming down the hill and washing away things as opposed to coming from the other direction. And so it would really be helpful, because I would like to integrate it into my activities in a way that people realize they have to take action.
Yeah, Santa Cruz is high on my list because they've got both the San Lorenzo River and the coast, and a lot of downtown is right at sea level. And I think one of the things we want to get cities to start thinking about are the multiple, you know, impacts. I mean, we're supposedly about to have what's called an arc storm hit the coast. Santa Cruz Mountains are going to get up to a foot of rain, according to our friends at NOAA. That's a lot of water coming down suddenly right into downtown Santa Cruz. And that's not the only coastal community that has that particular geography to worry about, although it's dear to our hearts, of course.
No, the other I was thing, on the city council during what we thought was a 100-year storm, right, when it rained 16 to 18 inches in 36 hours up in the mountains, which turns out now might be a 20- or 30-year storm
every
or
10
something.
Years, yeah. The other answer to your question is, of course, we, the Coastal Conservancy and the Coastal Commission, are both part of the COCAT, which meets regularly and involves every state agency that, you know, has skin in this particular game. And that's going to be another forum, I think, for us to keep people informed as to how this particular project is progressing.
Okay. Any other questions before we move to the speakers?
Yes, Alan. Comment, Sam.
Speak into the mic.
Yeah.
And you have to turn it on.
I think it's on. Green would be on.
Yeah, press the button. There, wherever it is.
Now it's on. Now it's on. It was on. Being in the legislature in the mid-90s, when we were dealing with the floods in the Mississippi River, they held a hearing and they brought out Brigadier General Garrison from the Army Corps, who at the time was responsible for hardening the Mississippi after they had to do some significant changes along the Corps' jurisdiction. And the one thing that we took out of that hearing was him admonishing us that the half-life memory of floods is to the next drought. And while we've had this big event on the East Coast, Sandy, and it's fresh in people's minds, the one comment I would have would be, we need to strike now, because shortly people are going to forget. We're going to be in a drought next summer. And, you know, while climate change is bringing on these big events, it doesn't mean we're going to have them every year. And it could be 5 years, it could be 10 years before we get another big one. And at that point in time, there'll be other issues. So I think people need to move now while we have those pictures of New York and New Jersey fresh in everybody's minds, and remind them that that's what California could be facing very, very shortly.
And I know from polling that we've done wearing a different hat that neither climate change nor flooding are anywhere near top of mind issues for hardly anyone. I mean, in the Bay Area, the only people that think about it really are folks in the North Bay whose rivers flood, you know, annually.
But neither were oil spills until BP, and then suddenly it subsumed everything.
Yeah.
Okay, anything? Perfect. Then, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say, on behalf of Assemblymember Atkins, I wanted to express their very strong support for this item and thank the council for proposing to direct resources for this purpose. As a legislator, she represents the coastal communities from Solana Beach to the southern border. So obviously this is a very high priority for her, and I wanted to just thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move to our speakers. Michael McCormick from the Office of Planning and Research is first, and Sean Bothwell from the California Coastkeeper Alliance is on deck.
Good morning, Chair and Council. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Our support letter didn't make it into the packet, wasn't completed in time for this meeting, but we're really excited to be here to support this grant program. OPR, one of our statutory authorities, is to support and encourage local governments to work on land use issues. We manage the general plan guidelines, and we work with our coastal partners like the Coastal Commission and the Ocean Protection Council and Coastal Conservancy on a number of different issues. And we see this as a really valuable opportunity to leverage some of the other grant programs that are in place throughout the state, like Strategic Growth Council and funding that's available through CalEMA, and would encourage the council as they as staff goes through developing the criteria for the grants to also think about leveraging some of these other grant opportunities to support more holistic action on the issue of climate change, particularly around adaptation. But we're really excited to see this, so just wanted to come and speak in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sean Bothwell is up, and Christy Foy from the City of Long Beach is on deck.
Good morning. My name is Sean Bothwell. I'm here today on behalf of the California Coastkeeper Alliance and its 12 California waterkeepers. Over the past 2 years, we have worked closely with OPC staff on developing its sea level rise resolution and the climate change section of the five-year strategic plan. Throughout these processes, our priorities for OPC with respect to sea level rise adaptation has been twofold. One, to encourage proactive ecosystem-based adaptation, and two, to provide funding and support for adaptation planning and sea level rise. We're thrilled to see the OPC take this action, which meets the second objective, and strongly support the OPC's dispersal of funding to local communities to support sea level rise adaptation work. I'd also like to say we also support the California Coastkeeper or California Coastal Commission's active participation in the development of these LCP plans. Looking forward, we hope to see funding prioritized for projects that integrate ecosystem enhancement and community planning for the mutual benefit of local ecosystems and communities. In developing adaptation plans and updating LCPs, OPC should encourage grantees to pursue restoration and buffering strategies that improve coastal resiliency by prioritizing adaptation strategies that enhance an ecosystem's natural adaptive capacity and limiting structural barriers such as seawalls. Creating buffers of open space around beaches and wetlands is a no-regrets adaptation policy. We support the issuance of guidance and or grants that emphasize the importance of ecosystem-based adaptation as these funds are administered. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll move to Christy Foy from the City of Long Beach, and Lila Monroe from NRDC is next up.
Hello, thank you. I'm Christy Foy here on behalf of the City of Long Beach in strong support for the grant funding for this coastal climate change assessments and planning. As you've mentioned, this proposal is very timely. As local governments plan for impacts of climate change on the coast, including sea level rise, amplified wave energy, and increased storm frequency and intensity. California's coastal communities are at the forefront of responding to and planning for these impacts. And so we thank you, and we're here in strong support.
Thank you very much. And next is Lila Monroe from NRDC, and Chris Mertens from the Nature Conservancy is next up.
Hi, Layla Monroe from NRDC, and actually I am going to offer NRDC's strong support, but on behalf of the review conducted by my new colleague, a woman named Julie Ekstrom, who's a PhD and actually participated and worked on the USC Sea Grant survey, and so was really thrilled to be able to offer comments, and is, I believe, would be very interested in offering more detailed comments in the future as this moves forward. She noted that this action item is really coming at a very excellent time when the science has matured and local communities really seem to have a very strong interest in acting. She also observed that this seed money could really trigger a snowball of additional funding towards these projects. The local communities that do take action in the near term can serve as models for other communities. And then, of course, it's really excellent to see the state supporting local communities in their adaptation efforts. There were two points that she suggested I convey regarding possible edits or additions to the project as written. She noticed that there is not really an acknowledgement of sort of the less tangible needs of communities beyond reports, plans, seawalls, et cetera, but that there's a very important need for communities to have funding for things like leadership, communications, networking, partnerships, these sort of cross-jurisdictional activities around planning. And additionally, she encouraged a consideration of a vulnerability assessment to include not just the infrastructure vulnerability, but also the social dimensions of vulnerability. So I'm sure she'd be happy to offer more input to staff, and thank you all very much for considering and hopefully adopting this item.
Thank you. And I think she should work with the staff on those items to make sure that we follow up as appropriate.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Chris Mertens of the Nature Conservancy, and then our last speaker who's on deck is Richard Sadowski.
Hi, Chair and members. My name is Chris Mertens on behalf of the Nature Conservancy. Sarah Newkirk, who is their coastal project director, I couldn't be here today. The Nature Conservancy also wishes to express strong support for the proposed sea level rise and shoreline hazards grant round. The state of California has been exceptionally proactive in its efforts to provide local governments with information and guidance to help integrate climate change projections into decision-making. Unfortunately, few communities have the resources or expertise to effectively use this information to inform local decisions, primarily as a result of factors such as inability to downscale climate risk information, lack of access to economic cost-benefit information, and the challenge of translating broad adaptation priorities into guidelines for their day-to-day activities. There have been numerous efforts designed to meet these challenges targeted at specific communities and spearheaded by diverse agencies and organizations. For example, the Nature Conservancy worked on a project in Ventura to help develop local sea level rise vulnerability information and tools for answering specific management questions. There's more information on that in the letter that I will submit after this. This grant round could provide funds for multiple communities to undertake vulnerability assessment and planning projects of their own and thereby increase their local resilience to inevitable sea level rise impacts. Further, by demonstrating the importance of these projects to a range of communities along California's coastline, you'd be advancing the proliferation of such projects even in communities that are not directly supported by this grant round. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here today. And the last speaker is Richard Sadowski.
Richard Sadowski, citizen, North Morro Bay. I also support staff on this issue, and also would like to add that I think it's important that funding get sent to the CCC in some manner with regards to this. As a wastewater collection system operator certified, I was on call 24/7 for sewage emergencies. And you talk about shoreline hazards is a dilapidated collection system that leaches onto our beaches, turns them into a cesspool. And I would like to see a lot of this money go into a tangible project. And one of the a few years ago, I wrote a proposal for a pilot that involved the communities of Los Osos, Morro Bay, and Cayucas, who are all at the same time looking at a collection system or a treatment system for a wastewater. One of the Los Osos has a septic where you can use basically using 21st century technology for these issues. And it is imperative that we start moving our wastewater treatment plants off the beach. It's ridiculous to even look at that and leaving that out there. And I'd like to thank you.
Thank you very much. The matter is now back before the council for any questions or comments or action.
I'll move the item.
Motion by Nance. Second by Gordon. Any further discussion?
Well, the only question I had was, and the staff report references, but that as I have the resolution and findings here, it talks about the council authorizing disbursement subject to two conditions, one of which is that the Conservancy shall coordinate with the Coastal Commission on grant criteria, and that each grant shall be submitted for subsequent review and approval by the OPC. But my understanding was that the staff had amended that so that the OPC itself would have the authority to, or the plan would be for the grant criteria to come to the OPC for review and approval at a future date. And I heard the director from the Conservancy say that as well. So subject to that understanding, because I would like to see how the criteria are written. And also, I'd like to know at that future date how it is, because I agree that one of the problems that I've seen in grant programs is that there are some communities that are very adept at putting together grant applications. They're not always, however, the folks that, from a statewide perspective, are the most in need of state grants. And so how are we going to make sure that we've got the right folks submitting grants and participating in this program so that we can make sure that we're really achieving our statewide objectives? So those would be the two things that I'd like to see, both the criteria coming back to us, and I understand we're in agreement on that, and then also some idea of what sort of outreach or how we're going to notice the availability of these grant funds to all communities and how we might reach out to certain communities to make sure that they're aware of this grant program.
I'll have Sam speak to the second question, and I'll just, unless the mover and the seconder contradict me, I'll say that was what their intent was in moving and seconding the motion.
That's a really good point. I just say to that at the Coastal Conservancy, we have 30 years of grant-making experience with every local government on the coast. So we are very attuned to what their capabilities are and what their funding situations are. And, you know, I think that when we bring you the RFP and the criteria, we will be able to write it in such a way that we can take that, you know, take that into account. But we do have a pretty good sense of, you know, who's good at writing grants versus who's good at actually performing.
Any further questions or comments before we move to a vote? Seeing none, we'll move to a vote. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. And thanks to everyone for that. We're going to move to item number 5, the Coast and Ocean Geospatial Data.
And we have a presentation by Laura Engman, who is here and has been working very hard on the geo portal and data for OPC along. She's going to give the presentation, but I would acknowledge her colleague, Claire O'Reilly, has also been her teammate throughout this.
Welcome.
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning, council members. It's a pleasure to see you. And I tried to come up with a title for this slide that was not such a big mouthful, and Claire and I have tasked ourselves by the next meeting with coming up with a proper one-word title for this project so that we can properly talk about it without
getting
hung up on
this. You were making me nervous that this is what you came up with after making it simple.
I know. It's either AB 2125 or geospatial information, and even geospatial information itself is like, you know, can we come up with a better term than this? But essentially, we're talking about geographic information, which are really cool maps, and I do have some visuals for you today. So less words, more visuals is my philosophy today. So I wanted, on behalf of myself and the staff, not just myself, but Claire O'Reilly and Scott Taves, this has been a major group effort on this project, and we're doing a lot of work with partners, so I'll be acknowledging them throughout my presentation today. So I'm just a face to a larger group of folks working on this. But I wanted to present you with essentially an update on what we've been doing since, I think we talked about this just about a year ago. And my update today is going to reflect partly what staff's efforts have been to implement Assembly Bill 2125, which, if you might remember, was introduced by Member Ruskin and passed in the legislature in 2010. It essentially assigned OPC with a leadership role in advancing access to and the use of geospatial information that was relevant to our ocean and coastal ecosystems and management and planning efforts. Since AB 2125 and we developed our strategic plan, we've integrated a lot of the tasks and mandates of AB 2125 into our strategic plan and added to that. So today's progress reflects both of those mandates. So progress, where are we? So as I mentioned, we came to you about a year ago When we did, we reported that we just completed this assessment of the agents of state agencies' geospatial data needs. That was finished in October 2011, and it was completed with substantial oversight and input from what's called the California Coastal and Marine Geospatial Working Group, another big mouthful. But essentially, that working group is largely our partners in the state agencies, GIS staff and non-GIS staff at those agencies that can provide input on how those agencies use this information, what they have at their agencies, and what their needs are, both technical and non-technical, as well as several NGOs and the NOAA Coastal Services Center. So once we finished that report, it essentially provided a set of strategies for improving access to and distribution of information between agencies and themselves and between agencies and the public. And included in that specifically was a recommendation to build a web portal known as a geoportal, and provided also some guides for developing that portal so that it met the needs highlighted in the report. So what we've been doing, coincidentally, when that report was completed and we were embarking on looking at building a geoportal, the state's geographic information officer announced plans to build an entire state geoportal for all geographic information across the state. And we saw an opportunity to really implement our recommendations in a cost-effective manner by partnering with the GIO on the development of this geoportal, and specifically to develop a coastal and ocean component to it. So today I'm pleased to provide a glimpse of the progress that's been made in developing this initial version of the state geoportal and this coastal and ocean component. What is a geoportal? Essentially, it's a one-stop web page for searching and accessing the state's authoritative geospatial information. And that includes, of course, coastal and ocean information. So there you have a search box which allows you to search that way. There'll be other ways that you can actually find and discover the data. Once someone finds the data, then he or she will be able to download it to their own computer using various programs and see it in, you know, either an ArcGIS software or even Google Earth, a more simplistic form. They'll also be able to see information about the data, including where it came from, when it was last updated, and the scope and extent of the data as far as its geography. And in addition to that, users will be able to view the data straight from the geoportal using what's called a portal viewer. And so this screenshot displays shipping lanes and marine protected areas in the Southern California Bight. It's just an example of how government staff and the general public might be able to display and discover information using this map viewer and the geoportal. And then, as I mentioned before, we're working on developing a specific coastal and ocean component of the geoportal, and this would further meet the needs that we highlighted in our 2001 assessment. This includes a dedicated starting page to discover coastal and ocean information. It also includes a viewer that would focus exclusively on the coast and ocean. And then it would also have a tools and resources page, which would essentially direct folks to other resources out there, such as California's Ocean Observing System data portals, which we hope to eventually integrate into the system, the Department of Fish and Game's Marine Biosystem, or like NOAA's Sea Level Rise Viewer. So in addition to progress on the geoportal, we're also making significant headway in increasing the dissemination and use of the significant state data investments, such as the seafloor mapping data and the high-resolution elevation data, or LIDAR data. We've included in the staff report, as you might have noticed, a list of where this data is now being used and how it's being used. And I wanted to give you a couple of examples today. So this is actually what's called a base map, and this is in the ArcGIS program, and also in Google Earth. They've also ingested this seafloor mapping data, so it now provides a base map for folks to view and plan on top of what's essentially a map of the seafloor. So that's for, you know, what we'd imagine maybe more technical users. And then on the non-technical end of the spectrum, folks like the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Exploration Center have also used the seafloor mapping data in a display to educate the public on what the geology of the ocean floor looks like, which we think is fabulous. And I also wanted to talk about the high-resolution LiDAR data, which is fast becoming a highly requested data set, largely for sea level rise modeling, such as the NOAA Sea Level Rise Viewer that you see here, as well as local efforts to map nearshore habitats like intertidal algae. Staff will continue to work with our partners to develop a wide variety of maps and products from this data and further expand the public benefit of these investments. And finally, as part of this progress that we've been making, we are all actively participating in the West Coast Governors Alliance Regional Data Framework. Last month, some of you might have seen the news notice that the WCGA received, and actually that number, I forgot to change it, is $850,000 in federal funding to develop a West Coast data network. OPC staff, its director, Kat, and our partners in our working group are all providing input on the work plan. And we essentially have the goal of leveraging federal funding, state resources, and these regional partnerships to really link California's resources with our partners in Oregon and Washington, as well as others at the federal level, and to further facilitate regional ocean resource management and allow folks to be able to look at the issues of our ocean and coastal ecosystems beyond our state boundaries. So in summary, OPC staff have been busy laying the groundwork for improving state agency and public access to the state's coastal and ocean information. And with GeoPortal development well underway, we look forward to spending 2013 working with specific agency staff, NGOs, academic institutions to refine the functionality of the GeoPortal that you see here, as well as the state data products so that we can better use them for management and planning efforts both in California and across the West Coast. With that, I'm happy to answer any specific questions that you have.
Thank you very much. We have one speaker, but let me ask before that if there are questions. Mr. Craven.
I just want to say that this project, from my perspective, is one of the key reasons, probably along with MLPA, why California's ocean work is viewed so highly around the region and around the nation and around the world. And I am looking very, very much looking forward to this project being finished and online and available to the public. And so thank you to everybody who's working on this.
Thank you.
Great. Let's ask Lila Monroe to make her comments, and then I'll do a last call for questions.
Thank you very much, Council Members. Layla Monroe with NRDC. I would just like to echo the statement of support for this work. Despite the very wonky name, the tools that OPC staff are building are really going to be tremendously useful in allowing agencies to do their jobs, I think, more efficiently and effectively. And we saw through the Marine Life Protection Act process how powerful readily accessible geospatial information can be in allowing stakeholders to map out their interests and sort of move beyond argument when you can make decisions based on biological criteria and based on hard data that's available in an accessible format. I'd also like to mention that the partnerships described in this project are really, I think, so valuable because they allow us to do more with less. And then finally, my one suggestion would just be that we not view this as a project that has an endpoint or a definitive endpoint. I think that it should be sort of a living, breathing entity, and that perhaps staff could consider identifying a priority list of next data layers to add and collect from the agencies and add for specific agency decision-making actions rather than action just as an end unto itself, but to identify those priority agency efforts that could most benefit from the addition of new layers to the GeoPortal. So thank you for considering my comments.
Thank you very much. And we have one other late ad to speak. Marla Jo Bruton would like to address this issue.
Good morning, Chairman. Is this on? Yeah, okay. I'm in support of this, and I'd like to say that it's gravely needed in the state of California, and I support any progress that we can make in integrating and collaborating and cooperating within different agencies in ocean management. I'm speaking today on behalf of citizens opposing acoustic seismic testing and Coast Alliance. We were just successful in getting a denial of the air gun blasting that was going to go off in my hometown, Front Yard, Morro Bay. And community did a lot of work in about 8 or 9 weeks worth of time. So I would like to say that any way that we can make gathering information easier for the public is one way that California can get what we need to get done accomplished. There are a lot of people out there with huge amounts of information, and when you compile them all together, you can be very successful in gathering data. One question we had is the LIDAR mapping. Is there any way that can be used to facilitate the seismic surveying that's being done? And another thing is the State Lands Commission really needs a very thorough checkup within the state. They have allowed this project to go on since 1984 on a permit that's just been rolled over, as is done on land-based development, and we need to put a stop to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments, and I'm sure the agencies you noted your comment. And if you would just make sure that you connected with the staff after the meeting in case there's a specific question you had that you do want answered, they will work with you on that. Any more questions or comments about this item? Let me just say thank you. We appreciate the progress report. That's good. We will all look forward to the new name and just appreciate the fact this is moving along. We'll move to item number 6, which is a report on the State Water Resources Control Board's proposed trash policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce Jonathan Bishop, who is the Chief Deputy Director for State Water Board, and has, I think, a long history with trying to eliminate trash in the state of California from the days when he was the executive officer down at the regional board in Los Angeles.
Thank you, and good morning. Nice to see you all again. I'm really here this morning asked to come and give you an update on where we are in our statewide water quality control plan for trash and litter. I think I've talked to this board a couple of years ago when we were first considering it, and now we've moved along significantly. As Kat told you, I worked on the trash TMDLs that were done in Los Angeles many years ago, and when I moved up here, this was an area that the state board was interested in moving forward with. And so we, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, the trash is a pervasive problem in our waterways and in the oceans. It is totally preventable, unlike many other of our pollution problems. There are a number of water quality impairments around the state that are listed for trash, and some that are I expect to be coming up in our next listing cycle. We have done a number of TMDLs in the Los Angeles and Southern California areas for trash. but they haven't. And then we also have a municipal stormwater permit in the San Francisco Bay Area that moved forward with trash controls as opposed to doing a trash TMDL. Part of the impetus for this is to move forward without doing hundreds of or potentially hundreds of TMDLs across the state, but doing one process, one administrative process to address the problem. The major source of trash in our waterways is from land-based sources, as you're aware, and most of that trash is transmitted through our storm drain system. And so this policy would affect all of our statewide plans, our inland surface water plans, our ocean plan, our closed bays and estuaries, and it would be based on a narrative objective of floating and settable materials. It has been a board priority for this this year to move forward on it, and we expect to build on the lessons we learned in the San Francisco Bay Area and in Los Angeles, and looking at targeting high trash generation areas in land use, things like industrial, commercial, resident, high density residential, and places essentially where people congregate are where we get trash. We've also seen that there are areas that don't produce as much trash, so we're in the process of identifying language that would allow us to concentrate on those areas that are the larger producers of trash and address somewhere in the percent of 85 to 95% of the trash by concentrating on these areas. We are looking for a implementation component to this policy, which would include two alternatives. One would be a structural control device alternative, which you see at the bottom here. These are using a proposed 5-millimeter mesh screen system and capture device that would go into the storm drain system. That is what's been done primarily in the Los Angeles area. They have turned out to be a lot more cost-effective than was originally envisioned. When we first were proposing this, the item on your far left, the it's called a vortex separation system, was the only device available, and they were hundreds of thousands of dollars.
A vortex separation system?
Yeah, the water spins in it, and it contains the trash, and the water moves out. These were the only thing available when we were proposing the trash TMDL in Los Angeles in 2000. Since then, you can see these other...
There's just a lot of vortexes I think people in this room would like to be separated.
Yeah, exactly. These other devices turned out to be in the hundreds of dollars instead of hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're quite economical to put in. They do increase the maintenance in the storm drain system by a little bit because you have to remove that trash. It's not going out to the waterway, and so it has to be pulled out of the system. But in terms of orders of magnitude, it's a much more cost-effective approach. And, I hate when they just, I'm just gonna click them all. Okay. This is giving you an idea of where we are in the process. We've had CEQA scope meetings early on where we put out, you know, kind of our what we were thinking about and potential ways to address it. We convened a public advisory group in 2011, and they've been meeting for a little over a year and a half now or so, made up from folks from cities, from the environmental community, from plastics industry, and they have been working through the concepts and ideas with my staff as we go along. We expect to release our substitute environmental document, which will include a draft proposal of the plan in early 2013, so probably January, February timeframe, and then hold public hearings in the spring and a workshop in the summer and bring it to our board for consideration fall, winter of about a year from now, I would expect. And that's all I have. I was two things were requested of me: make it short and to the point, and wear a very colorful tie. And I hope that I accomplished both of those. And I'm ready to respond to any questions.
I note that it's a Jerry Garcia tie.
Yes, it is.
And so it must have some name.
This is the California Mission tie.
As usual.
bears almost no resemblance
to... Unless you're Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, exactly. But for people out there in webcast land, I just thought they would want to know that.
Gotta move over there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, just we have five speakers. I'm going to call on them, and I'm going to have to leave partway through the speakers. But let me make one comment beforehand, which is that when I said earlier in this meeting that there were three or four things that probably really rose to the top in being priorities, and we were talking about ocean acidification then, and we have marine protected areas, and another one that is probably in the top whatever you would list is marine debris. And so it is very important. This is central to how we affect that. And so while it might seem to somebody watching that that was somewhat of a bureaucratic process, let me remind them what the overall goal is and why it is important and why you're here and why we're asking people to work with you to focus on that project, because it is really important because all these actions on land are really affecting what it is. And a lot of times people don't make those connections, and that's what this is designed to do. So I appreciate it. Let's start. The first person that is asked to speak is Sean Bothwell, and Lila Monroe is on deck.
Good morning again. Sean Bothwell, staff attorney for the California Coastkeeper Alliance. I'm also a member of what Jonathan was just speaking about, the Trash Policies Public Advisory Group. And as a member of that group and on behalf of California Coastkeeper Alliance, I'd like to strongly support the State Water Board's work to develop this policy and also ask that the OPC continue to support a strong policy out of the State Water Board. The OPC has been a long-time leader and crucial advocate for marine debris. They had an OPC resolution in 2007, and they've produced multiple studies and reports highlighting the concerns of plastic pollution. OPC has also identified marine debris as a top priority in its five-year strategic plan, objectives 10.1 and 10.2. California Coastkeeper Alliance suggests implementation of both these objectives sooner rather than later to help support the State Water Board's efforts. We'd also suggest reconvening the Marine Debris Steering Committee to coordinate statewide efforts to reduce trash in the ocean. Specifically, the steering committee can focus on its efforts on source control strategies as a complement to what the State Water Board's doing. Plastic pollution source control is a crucial and necessary action to be taken. The State Water Board, unfortunately, does not have the authority to regulate source control measures. They simply can regulate the discharge of plastic pollution or marine debris into our water bodies. So I think the OPC can play really a crucial role in coordinating the state agencies that do have a role in source control and managing that in a better fashion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I will move to Lila Monroe, and Nathan Weaver is on deck.
Council, Lila Monroe from NRDC. I just would like to express my strong support for what the State Water Resources Control Board is doing. We're very eager to see the release of the report and the SED. And I would just offer that I had the opportunity this summer to travel to Rio to go to the UN Conference on Sustainable Development to actually work on precisely this issue, which is stopping solid waste, and especially plastic, from entering the marine environment before it gets, on land, before it gets to the marine environment, because once it's in the ocean, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to clean up in many cases. And so globally, from Ecuador to India, people around the world have the same reaction that Secretary Laird described, that solid waste is sort of a visual manifestation of all the other types of pollutants, like the carbon pollution and the nutrient loading that we dump into our ocean. And so it's really important to, I think, acknowledge that this is sort of like a gateway issue into ocean issues, and that if we can take action and be a leader, not just in the nation, in utilizing the very powerful Clean Water Act to this additional end, but also thinking about ways that we can solve this problem that can then be shared with our neighbors around the world, I think it's really important. So I'm excited to engage in the future. And it looks like he has a question.
Question, Mr. Gordon. And if you could move next to the mic.
Are the regulatory pathways...
Your mic isn't on.
Yeah, all right. Are the regulatory pathways for solid waste clear on this? I mean, beyond local stormwater capture basins, I mean, you've got solid waste is controlled by the waste board. The water board has... This is really non-point source is what we're talking about here. Do we have any... Is there a clear regulatory program statewide for non-point source solid waste? Because that is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the Water Board has identified the best regulatory mechanisms for addressing this particular non-point source of pollution. So I don't know of a better alternative, perhaps Jonathan would have. I mean, I think that the sections that they are pursuing are probably the best we have, but...
Would you like to take a whack at that question?
So, just really quick, those stormwater, by you know, kind of obvious thinking, would be a non-point source. Under the Clean Water Act, it's a point source, and so we're regulating it through a kind of a point source regulation approach with this policy, and then it would be implemented through our stormwater permits throughout the state. We also have components about dealing with areas that are. More traditional, like a beach or a park that are next to a water body where there is problems with trash. We don't really want to overregulate these areas. They have enough problems as it is. But what we do want to do is make it available that this tool could be available for helping in those areas. So,
okay. Then Nathan Weaver is up with Sue Vang on deck.
So good morning. My name is Nathan Weaver. I am the Oceans Advocate for Environment California. We are a statewide grassroots environmental advocacy organization, and our members are very concerned about marine debris and especially plastics and especially their effect on wildlife. We were very encouraged by the Water Board and OPC's efforts to address the trash issue and to intercept trash before it can become marine debris. I wanted to alert you all that there are, in addition to what we've talked about, front-end solutions that would not require infrastructure investment by the taxpayer. These include banning unnecessary single-use disposable products like styrofoam cups or plastic bags, and I note that over 50 communities in California have already taken this step with respect to plastic bags. In addition, you can modify products to reduce their environmental impacts. These include leashing the bottle caps to plastic bottles so that they don't float to the surface where birds or fish can encounter them. And I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to comment. In the future, I and our members hope that the OPC, the Water Board, and the broader policy community will take a very holistic look at solving the marine debris problem. Thank you.
Thank you. And the next speaker is Sue Vang.
Good morning, Sue Vang with the environmental group Californians Against Waste. We're here today in strong support of an effective policy from the Water Board. We're hoping to see effective measures that will reduce plastic pollution and other waste in our waterways. And I know that some of the other speakers have already talked about source control and single-use bag ordinances. I just wanted to share a statistic about how effective these are. In LA County, which adopted a single-use bag ordinance in 2010, reported earlier this year a 95% reduction in all single-use bags in their covered stores. So I think that's a great number to share with you today. The other thing I wanted to note is that in February of 2007, the council adopted a resolution to reduce marine debris and recommending things such as expanding the bottle bill to include plastic containers that are commonly found in marine debris. So we would urge the council to consider renewing those recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any further comments from the council on this?
Yes, I've got a question for Jonathan, and because trash that doesn't get sucked into the vortex makes its way down into the harbor, at
yes,
least from
does.
The LA basin. And so I actually have a staff member who his entire job is to go out in a specialized vehicle and collect trash. We call it the Big Dipper. And so with all of the plastic bag ordinances that the cities are doing, I've asked him if he would keep track of the amount of trash he collects to see if there's a reduction. Not very scientific, but so it made me wonder, and I don't recall how long the LA River TMDL for trash is in place, but is there any sort of data that shows?
Yes, there is.
Reductions.
I didn't bring all the numbers with me, but I can have it. I can get that information to your executive director.
I'm just curious how effective it was.
So we, as you remember, the trash TMDL was supposed to go into effect in 2012, and then there was lawsuits, and it didn't really go into effect until I think it was 2007. And so it's about 50%, 60% contained. That's what I remember off my reduction. We have lots of information about how much trash was intercepted. So how much went into this, was taken out of the storm drain system. It doesn't necessarily tell you, how much reduction there was in the waterway because it's variable up and down. But we know what we've captured that would have been in the waterway, and it's in the hundreds of tons of trash.
Right.
It's a really good success story. And it's been fairly well implemented. There's a number of cities that are already 100% of their trash is collected through blow our own horn. We gave $16 million to the gateway cities to through a grant, and they've captured all the stormwater through there. So we've given many grants to folks along the LA River. I would hope that eventually your staff person would be down to a part-time
basis.
it won't.
Right.
We do recognize that even if we can capture all of the stormwater, there is still direct deposit and windblown drop deposits that are not controllable through the storm drain system, but the vast majority comes through that.
Well, we're going to track it, and I'm curious to see what's going to happen.
So. Great.
Okay, thank you. Well, two things. First, I'm sort of disappointed that Secretary Laird did not actually run from the meeting at 11:30. I was sort of looking forward to seeing him run Stephen Colbert-like up through the middle, slapping hands with the audience. And two, any faith he might have in my ability to run this meeting is probably misplaced since I neglected to call the next speaker on this item. The name seems to be George Leonard. Is that – you could approach the mic.
Sorry about that.
No, my apologies.
Hi, George Leonard from Ocean Conservancy, and if you'll just bear with me, I forgot to support AB 2125. I forgot to get my card in. We're a big fan of the bill. We supported it, and we look forward to working with everybody to advance it. As you may know, Ocean Conservancy organizes the International Coastal Cleanup every September around the world, including here in California, and marine debris is a major program area for ours. We're just here to support the Water Board's efforts. It's a huge contribution to this problem, and we have a lot of data that may help inform this question of, you know, how things change and what kind of improvements are made. So thanks for all your work on that.
Okay, thank you. Well, now I think we've gone through all the public comment on this. Are there any other comments from the members of the council? If not, thank you for the presentation. We appreciate it and look forward to hearing future updates on how this program is progressing. And so now we'll move to item 7, I believe, which is the report evaluating the impact of 40 years of implementing the Clean Water Act.
Thank you, Secretary Rodriguez. I'd like to welcome here today Ken Schiff, who's the Deputy Director of the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. And they have been leaders in water quality in the Southern California Bight and on beyond that for many years. And so it's really a pleasure to have Ken here to give a presentation reflecting on the progress that has been made in cleaning up the Southern California Bight using Clean Water Act tools.
Good late morning to you all. Thanks for inviting me. I'm here to talk about the Clean Water Act and the state regulations like the Port of Cologne Act that happened right around 40 years ago. So once again, I'm just the conduit. If hopefully you all got a copy of the document. If you look on the back page, there's actually over two dozen authors, which are the scientists and managers from the four largest wastewater treatment plants, not just in the state, but in the nation, that discharge to the coastal ocean, the extremely large municipal stormwater dischargers,
each of the three regional boards, from regional water quality control boards from Southern California, the state board, and actually OPC staff. So that's my good way to try and convince you that we got good collaboration amongst different sides of the house. The real pragmatic reason we did this project is because a bunch of them are getting ready to retire. They're the only ones that remember what it was like way back in the day. And we knew if we didn't capture the information, the data, now we might not ever get it. So, that being said, what we did was collate the data from the last 40 years as best we could. It's just so that you know, that's about 200,000 samples per year just in Southern California of discharge, effluent-type discharge, as well as data from the receiving water basically in the ocean. And of that data, we asked four questions. Basically, how have the pollutant inputs changed? Have they gone up, gone down, stayed the same? Is the ecosystem protected? Is it safe to eat the fish? Is it safe to swim? These are all questions that were in the original Clean Water Act. So kind of to give you the setting, this is population levels for the last 100-plus years for the four or five coastal counties from Southern California. If you go from 1971 to 2010, over that four-decade period where the Clean Water Act and the Puerto Colon Act were in effect, population in Southern California doubled, right? And, of course, along with that came double the number of toilets, double the number of showers, double, by extension, the double the amount of business, and double the amount of cement and hardscape on our watersheds. This graphic illustrates the amount of inputs, and this is just from cumulatively all the wastewater treatment plants in Southern California. So just looking at the top line there, it started out at about 350 billion gallons a day of treated wastewater going to the ocean or back at the time when Clean Water Act was initiated, and it's still about 350 billion gallons a day 40 years later. And you could see what happened is it started rising kind of at about the same level as the population. And then right around 1989, 1990, it started going down. So drought, that's what drove the initial reductions. And then the aha moment of, hey, reclamation and reuse is a good thing. And so so that's actually one good message that comes out of some of that regulation. The second thing is the darker blue kind of area plot there, which represents the cumulative or the proportional amount of increased treatment. Back in 1970, that was all primary or advanced primary treatment, kind of lower levels of sewage treatment going directly to the ocean. Now, as much as 90% of the sewage, treated sewage, has this advanced secondary treatment. And along with that goes the two lines that you see that have been slowly declining over time, which is the amount of total suspended solids, the amount of biological oxygen demand, TSS and BOD. If you know anything about sewage treatment plants, those are good generic markers of how well sewage treatment is working. And it's been going down over time, 90% reductions over the four decades. Really pretty astounding, given double the amount of population. And what's good is if you actually look, instead of looking at these general markers, you actually look at actual pollutants, pesticides, heavy metals, a lot of nutrients. They've gone down this much or more. So kudos to the state regulatory agencies that have helped make that happen. How has the ecosystem responded? Here's a graph that shows fin erosion. So if you look at the photo there on the right side, there's three fish. This is a Pacific sand dab. It's one of the most ubiquitous fishes in Southern California. It's a flatfish. It lies on the bottom next to the sediment where the pollutants accumulate. And the top fish is healthy fish. Looking good. You'll find it at some of your upscale seafood restaurants. The fish in the middle has a big black, blacky blob in the middle of it. That's actually a tumor. So the bottom fish, if you see the edges are ragged, that's because its fins have eroded, or fin rot, as the commercial fishermen call it. The graphic shows, starting in 1970, the percent of fish with this fin erosion, or this fin rot. And you could see, back when the Clean Water Act first started, a third of the fish, maybe almost up to a half of the fish we'd find near sewage, in this case near a sewage treatment plant, had this fin rot. And as the BOD, the TSS, and the pollutants have decreased and the sewage treatment has increased, put the same thing else on the last plot. It's dropped down to near zero. It's extremely rare to see this anymore. So good recovery, at least for this part of the ecosystem. This graphic, while looks complicated, is actually not that tough. So the different rows are different locations in Southern California. You start in the north, near Santa Barbara, go down as you move south, down to the border, basically. And each plot is a different chemical that's found in edible fishes of that fish up in the left corner. That's a kelp bass, and it's always one of the top five most commonly caught sport fish in Southern California. And the concentrations in each of these plots are in the edible tissues. I'm going to start at the plot on the far right. So that's for total DDT. It's a pesticide. It was banned back right when the Clean Water Act was passed. And you see a neat spatial pattern. Right near Palos Verdes, you see this big spike. We have a Superfund for DDT there. So now look at the dotted line and the solid line, the vertical line. That's the California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment action levels. The dotted line begins warning risks. The solid line is a no consumption. It doesn't even come close to those anymore. So, in fact, it's an order of magnitude away from those thresholds. So that's a good thing. Back in the 1970, it was definitely over the solid line. So now look at the graphic all the way to the left. That's for mercury. So this one, not only do you not see a spatial pattern, but almost all of them are over kind of the initial thresholds that OEHA would consider limited consumption. There's none over the no consumption limit, so that's good, but it's everywhere. And that's despite what I showed you in the last graphic, that we've gotten rid of virtually all the mercury from sewage treatment plants. So there's different sources for mercury. Around the late 80s, beginning 90s, there was an attention that shifted to managing runoff. And there's lots of reasons for that. But there were three landmark studies that focused attention on why it should be done. That was as the wastewater pollutants decline, the stormwater pollutants, or the pollutants that came from runoff, either staying the same or going up. So they're proportionally more pollutants coming from that source. The second thing was, while we saw that it's generally safe to swim at most of the beaches in Southern California, where it was bad was always near flowing storm drains. And then, of course, an epidemiology study that showed people actually get sick swimming near flowing storm drains. And that, to this day, is the basis for our water quality standards. So what happened? Folks decide, well, let's treat the runoff like we treated the wastewater. This graphic shows cumulative amount of low flow diversion. So at the end of a stormwater pipe, you divert it to the sewage treatment plant. And I think the other interesting thing about this graphic is this increase comes almost directly from just state-funded Clean Beach Initiative grants. This isn't a lot of federal money, like we did with the sewage treatment plants that showed all that increase. This is from state bond funds. And this is the response at the beaches. So this is an example where, starting around 2001 to 2010, the increase in beach water quality. So Heal the Bay has a report card. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. This is the proportion of beaches that got grades of A or B. I could show you a mirror image graphic that goes down of the DNF beaches. And, so it went from 80% of the beaches were doing pretty well to now 95%. So the investment in the Clean Beach Initiatives, this is the result. And while you could say that's great, or gosh, that's not that much, it's an increase of 15%. But when you think that we have 175 million beachgoers in Southern California, this turns out to be a lot of people that are no longer exposed. Okay, so to end with the Clean Water Act, definitely had an impact. Pollutants have gone down. Our biota is looking better. The vast majority of our beaches are safe to swim and the seafood's safe to eat. I mean, there's still problems, but at least we know where they are, even though they might be difficult to resolve. But the future issues, some of which have come up today, those are the real challenge to the Clean Water Act, right? Because it was formulated for these point sources, it was formulated for pipes. Even John just told you they're trying to deal with trash through pipes. But these other emerging issues are no longer local.
They're not pipes. Things like emerging contaminants and ocean acidification and hypoxia, you don't solve by end of pipes. So just to give you an example, here's contaminants of emerging concern. Through the State Water Board, they hired an expert workshop. This data comes basically out of their report. And there's 100,000 of these new chemicals. A lot of them are industrial, but you can see there's different flavors. That compares to the 126 that are on the Clean Water Act priority pollutant list. So really, there's only 126 that are actually regulated. So what do we do with the rest? Many of them, we have no method to even measure them. We don't know what the effects are. So the traditional Clean Water Act of permit limits for specific chemicals, that's not going to work for this. So there's new challenges ahead for this. The other, of course, is the ocean acidification, hypoxia. They kind of go together because they kind of co-occur. So this data comes from NOAA. This is off their buoy in Hawaii. We have a buoy here in Southern California. I'm just showing this one because it's got a longer time series than California. If you saw Al Gore's film, you'd recognize the red line, which is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. What he didn't show was the blue and the blue-green line, which is the amount of CO2 in seawater and then increasing over time and the commensurate reduction in pH. And so so the California data shows an even steeper decline in pH. And so ocean acidification, whatever the mechanism, it's actually occurring. So solving these large-scale problems, these global problems, Clean Water Act is going to have to adapt. And so there's several questions, like how much do we worry about these global scale sources versus local source? Can we resolve at least some of it by looking at local sources? What can we do either with new technology or perhaps new management techniques to try and resolve these large scale threats or at least adapt to them? These are all things that are going to be challenges for the Clean Water Act. The good news, of course, is that OPC staff and the council are already making the steps forward, some of them during the director's report and Skyly's report, trying to bring these new, bring folks together to address these issues. That's going to be the new frontier. And that concludes my talk.
Well, thank you. Are there any questions?
Just a quick question. In terms of your last subject of future challenges, have you or your group or your colleagues or just in your day-to-day activities thought about whether there are policy or legal recommendations that would be necessary or that you would advance to amend state law to deal with those issues?
Okay, so I'll start my answer by saying I'm a humble scientist.
Yeah.
Some of the things we heard today, I think, are steps in the right direction, like the cap and trade stuff and AB 32. Those are going to help resolve some of the issues. The other thing that I think is really valuable, of course, is kind of the melding of the different silos of management that we have in the state, which you guys are actually trying to break down those silos just by being on this council. Those are really important steps forward. The other thing I'd kind of talk about is before I kind of give you a lot of those recommendations, I'm actually going to put it on Skyly and her staff with the science advisory team. That's the whole deal of trying to pull those experts together so they can give you concrete decisions. Some of the things that came out of the Washington report are appropriate. Some of them maybe not. Well, that's what we need to find out.
Okay, thanks. I'll track down Skyly separately.
Any other questions from the council? Seeing none, we've got four speakers. Let me call first Sean Bothwell. And he will be followed by Linda Sheehan.
Hi, Sean Bothwell, California Coastkeeper Alliance. I just wanted to real quickly talk about something Ken said about how the Clean Water Act needs to really evolve and be able to handle these global issues such as climate change. And we just spoke about it, actually, about possible legal hooks, if you will, to start getting at some of these issues. And one of them I wanted to bring to your attention is the State Water Board is currently working on its 303D listings for impaired waterways. And we would just recommend that the OPC support this idea of listing water bodies that are impaired by low flows as climate change progresses and we begin to see less snow you know, up in the mountains and therefore less runoff. We're going to see lower flows. We're already seeing them now. And there are water bodies out there that, could be benefited by being put on this list. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Linda Sheehan, and she will be followed by Richard Sadowski.
Good morning. I'm Linda Sheehan, Executive Director of Earth Law Center. Earth Law Center works to advance rights-based protections in law for ecosystems and species. And I was invited by SCORP to provide the non-governmental perspective in its Clean Water Act report, and I was very pleased to do so. I believe I was probably in there because I'm old enough to remember pre-Clean Water Act waterways, and they were not pretty. Before I launch into my comments, I did want to respond quickly to Mr. Craven's question with regard to amendments in state law, because I can't help myself. I scribbled down two amendments and two policy changes. One would be a citizen supervision in Porter Cologne is really critical, or some sort of citizen supervision related to environmental laws. Water rights for waterways. Oregon has a beginning program that I think we can learn from and evolve from there. And then two changes that are more policy changes. One is just mentioned by Sean with regard to listing waters impaired by flow. And the other is integrating flows into water quality regulations and permits. So happy to talk with you more about that. In my remarks in the SCORP report, I noted that we've all benefited tremendously, me personally and all of us, and waterways themselves from the Federal Clean Water Act and its implementation over the years. But we're still seeing continued degradation, as you just heard. And in fact, the world's top marine scientists have said and are continuing to say that marine degradation is happening at a pace faster than expected due to ocean acidification and numerous other threats that we're facing. Amending the Clean Water Act will help start to change some of this, but by itself is unlikely to achieve the type of significant systemic changes that we need to make in order to reverse the degradation that we're seeing, not slow it, but actually reverse it. California currently doesn't enjoy rights-based protections in law for ecosystems and species, and our organization is working to evolve the law in that direction. But in the meantime, we're also working to evolve more holistic regulatory and monitoring systems that would support rights-based protections in law and that would better reflect what we're learning in science all the time about our interconnectedness with the environment. And so I'd like to highlight two points from my written comments that Mr. Schuchat is so kindly passing out. First, the OPC has been a leader, an acknowledged leader in championing cutting-edge ocean science. And I would urge the OPC to embrace as well a role of championing cutting-edge ocean and environmental law. The California Ocean Protection Act states that the OPC has a mandate to identify recommended changes in coastal and ocean law to be able to effectuate COPA's goals. Layering, what we're doing now is we're seeing sort of layering of new science onto existing regulatory structures. And it's important to consider science as we're implementing current law, but we also want to look at how we need to change law in order to reflect modern science. So as a specific ask, we'd like the OPC to develop a process by which it will identify and recommend needed changes in law in order to recognize this evolving science and take action based on the effectiveness or not of our existing governance systems. And our second ask is related to specifically the discussion of the Clean Water Act that we're having and some of its gaps. And would ask more particularly, again, that the OPC take up this process of implementing and recommending changes in law and policy and applying that towards water issues, specifically looking at water rights for waterways and integrating water flows issues with water quality regulations and permits. Numerous studies are tying in adequate inland flows with the health of anadromous species, coastal ecosystems, and estuaries. But what we have not done as much work in integrating this information we have on water flows with law. And so one specific action that we can take now as we're working on sort of this evolution of law is what Mr. Bothwell just mentioned, is making sure that the current 303D list that's being developed right now includes waterways impaired by altered flows. This is something that a number of other states are doing. We haven't done this yet in California. There's certainly an opportunity. Some inland waterways that are important to salmon have no water at all for much of the year. That's clearly something that could be listed. And I look forward to working with the Ocean Protection Council and its staff on this larger issue of evolving ocean science and ocean law, and at the smaller level, working at the immediate process to identify all waterways impaired by altered flows in the 303D list. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and I want to assure you that we do have your letter, and we'll take a look at it, and I'll be discussing it with the State Water Resources Control Board staff, and we'll look forward to hearing from you in the future. Next up is Richard Sadowski, followed by Marla Jo Bruton.
Richard Sadowski, Citizen Morro Bay. Mentioned earlier, I was a grade 4 wastewater collection system operator, and I appreciate the presentation, but one of the problems that we're having with the Clean Water Act, the way it's implemented, you're looking at wastewater treatment plants. First of all, wastewater treatment plant outfalls dumping into the ocean should be a thing of the past. We need to start recharging our aquifers. We need to start reclaiming the water. One of the biggest problems that we have with the Clean Water Act is we don't take the collection system and the treatment system as one unit. Now, I worked in the collection system for a special district. Now, special districts are operated throughout California, except I think in San Francisco. And they're run like a business, okay? Now, it's good business for a special district that only has to deal with sewage being pumped to another area to have it leach out, because they get paid on how much gets pumped. Now, I've personally witnessed board members breaking a sewer main, sticking a pipe in, hooking up a lateral, having it leach out because it's good business. Because the less that you pump, the less that you get charged for. Now, we need to tighten the Clean Water Act to incorporate these collection systems and these failures. And one of the other ways we can deal with these things, these issues, is the revolving door policy that's been given regarding variances or waivers. The Morro Bay and Cayucas still hasn't met the 40-year requirement of the Clean Water Act, still operating under a waiver. Should have been one-time deal. Should by 1980, it should have been done. Should be at least due in secondary. So, you know, doing the regarding the Clean Water Act, it's a matter of public trust, and we need to have people in position that take the public trust. And another thing that needs to be protected is our drinking water aquifers. One of the highest energy uses is pumping water around. We start protecting our drinking water aquifers from getting sewage pollution like we have in Morro Bay. You start addressing that issue, you don't have to take state water. That could be available for another community or farming. And we start protecting our drinking water aquifers. This is incorporating AB 32, cap and trade. These could all be integrated. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker is Marla Jo Bruton.
Good afternoon, Marla Jo Bruton, North Morro Bay. And 40 years of implementing the Clean Water Act. I'd like to say that, in my opinion, the Clean Water Act is an excellent document, and really, I mean, I know we would have to go into a lot of sessions about amending it, but number one is I believe that it needs to be enforced. And in California, through whatever reasons, it hasn't been enforced, and it hasn't been a standard goal even within communities. As far as amending it, if you really read that document, which I have and I've studied it, it's an amazing document, and I don't see a need to amend it. I think we do need to not neuter the document, and that would be my concern with a legislative amendment to that document, is that it would be neutered instead of enforced. As far as the presentation today, we had, how have pollutant inputs changed? And the last sentence in there is, controlling pollutants in runoff is now a focal point for water quality management. And I think that we're overlooking a huge, huge problem in one of the most populated states in America. We have a lot of people that use the bathroom every day. I believe that the UC Davis nitrate pollutant study that focused on farm runoff, that would go right in here, so they'd be looking at these pollutants in the water quality management runoff section. In that document, it's stated that the sewage pollution from sewage was not analyzed because there's not enough data points to even look at that within the state of California. And one problem with that is that it's not electronically gathered. I would urge this number one thing Ocean Protection Council could do is to the LIDAR geoportal, get a portal going for the sewage treatment. Everyone's looking at me. I know it's a big thing to say, but I mean, it's completely left out of that UC Davis nitrate study. And people jump to the conclusion that what they can study is the problem when they have not looked at the other huge part of that nitrate pollution. And then also, as far as the cap and trade, I would like to see the sewage industry come up to speed and become a standard in California that any wastewater treatment plants use methane conversion. How this is going into the ocean is the gas, the greenhouse gas effect and ocean acidification and what have you. So it may sound like I'm talking outside of the box, but I really don't think we can talk outside of the box anymore. So it's a simple point. The sewage treatment industry is a simple point source that is readily available for conversion methods to capture greenhouse gases and thereby improve the ocean. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'll just... did you want have something you want to say?
I just did want to clarify, because I didn't want people who are on the webcast or in the room to think that there isn't a system statewide for capturing data related to sewage treatment plants. There is, in fact, an extensive data system, and Jonathan probably could go on for hours about it, but perhaps we could provide that information to the last speaker.
Okay.
And so that would be the direction to you. You should talk to Jonathan. I don't think we need any more testimony.
Just
you might
thing.
Want to talk to
John. That's not SCADA. I'm not talking about SCADA. I'm talking about collections. If it doesn't get there, if the collections are just...
Okay, thank you. Yes, and as I said, I'd suggest that you talk to Mr. Bishop. I appreciate the testimony. Is there any further questions from the council? I'll just say that I found this very, very helpful. One of the things that, I talk about is I go around the state reluctantly giving speeches is there's a tendency to live in the here and now and to not have a context or perspective on how these programs that we've adopted and have been enforcing over a long period of time are really working. And it's a very important point for us to get out. I know that there is cynicism about some of these programs, but if you look at the last 40 years, really, when we've adopted and have been implementing a variety of programs in air and water, in energy, There are success stories to tell. You've heard the success stories here, the fact that California has doubled its population and only seen an increase in 4% in its overall energy consumption is a great example of how energy efficiency can work. If you look at how water is being reused in Southern California today, that's an example of what you can do if you put your mind to it. We are going to make our renewable energy standards and goals for 2020. So it cuts across the board. I think it's quite reasonable for us to expect that Cal Recycle is going to meet its 75% goal for recycling waste in California. So we can achieve these things if we really put our minds to it. This kind of report helps us to really make that point. So I really appreciate the time you took today in bringing that to us. And I'll see what I can include from here in my next speech. So thank you. Let's go on to, council member requests for future agenda items. Do you have anything that you want to say on that, Kat? No? Okay. Are there any suggestions from the members of the council? Okay. Okay. Yeah. My attention span is about 2 hours, so I'm sure I'll think of something after we leave here. But we can bring that up to you. Let me then go on to public comment on non-agenda items. I have four speaker request forms here. So let me start with Sean Bothwell. And he will be followed by Terry Shore. And in view of the hour, if I could ask you to keep it brief, but we'll be listening carefully. And that's why we look at people when they're speaking. So.
Good afternoon. Sean Bothwell again, staff attorney for California Coastkeeper Alliance. The Alliance just wanted to show its appreciation and gratitude to OPC staff for its work and commitment, working with the Department of Water Resources on the Near Coastal and Oceans section of the Water Plan update. This is a new section for the Water Plan, and I just can't stress enough our appreciation to Director Coleman for the input to the DWR. Beyond collaborating with the Department of Water Resources on the Ocean Plan, I would also stress that the OPC expand its efforts in implementing Strategic Plan Objective 9.1 to support an integrated approach to water management that minimizes harm to the health of downstream ocean and coastal ecosystems. California needs to reform its water management policies. This isn't anything shocking to anybody. The state is beginning to move in the direction of integrated water management. The only problem with that is I don't think anyone can really give one definition of what integrated water management is. I personally would define integrated water management as the prioritization of a set of principles and practices to maximize social benefits and minimize adverse impacts. These are things like conservation, water reuse, stormwater capture, prioritizing those over less beneficial water supply options. However, this logical approach to water management is currently not being done due to our fragmented government and, you know, siloed agencies. The underlying principle of integrated water management needs to be cooperative efforts by multiple government agencies, non-government organizations, industry, and the members of the public to prioritize water management reforms that result in multi-beneficial solutions. I can think of no better entity to begin collaboration on properly defining what integrated water management needs to be going forward than the OPC. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next speaker will be Terry Shore, and I understand that there was a discussion with Chairman Laird, Secretary Laird, about having a five-minute presentation, so that's fine. If you can proceed, that'd be great.
Yes, good afternoon, council members and staff. My name is Terry Shore. I'm program director for Turtle Island Restoration Network. We're an international marine conservation group based in Marin County, and our flagship species is the sea turtle, seaturtles.org. And I appreciate the time to speak. The reason that I'm here today is because the California Ocean Protection Council has consistently demonstrated support for endangered Pacific leatherback sea turtle conservation and sustainable fisheries along our coast. as a Pacific leatherback was recently named an official state symbol of California, it seemed timely to provide the OPC with an update on the status of this endangered species that utilizes our coastline. We're also here today to seek OPC action and support to help prevent a federal proposal to expand the high bycatch California drift gillnet fishery for swordfish and shark into protected leatherback habitat, which conflicts with longstanding California policy to limit this high bycatch fishery. So my first slide is just to make everyone aware, this is our latest state symbol. The leatherback is now the official marine reptile of California. It passed through the state legislature, AB 1776, Assemblyman Fong, on a unanimous bipartisan vote and was signed by Governor Jerry Brown on September 26th. One of the things that this bill does is designate October 15th every year as official Leatherback Conservation Day. That kind of is the time of the year when the presence of these leatherbacks peaks. So I assume that is for forward. Yay. The reason that this leatherback is a symbol of state of the state of California is because these sea turtles swim all the way across the ocean from Indonesia, where they nest to feed on jellyfish along our coastline. And we know this now without any shadow of a doubt due to satellite telemetry. Okay, here we go. And actually, today, the California coast is essentially turtle safe. It's one of the few safe havens for the endangered leatherback sea turtle. This is a critically endangered species. 90% of its population is already gone. They do continue to decline, unfortunately, at an average rate of about 6% per year for this Western Pacific population. There is as few as 1,000 to 1,500 nesting females left. However, we are doing our best to help protect these sea turtles. This year, in fact, the Endangered Species Act critical habitat was designated along our coast, about 16,000 square miles along our central coast. That means any projects, whether it's aquaculture or wave energy, new power plants, anything along our coast that could impact the habitat of the leatherback, their access to it, and the jellyfish would need to be considered and mitigated. And for over a decade, we've had a large swath of our coastline off limits to the California drift gillnet fishery because of take of these endangered sea turtles in the past. So between mid-August and mid-November, there's no fishing allowed by the California drift gillnet fishery for swordfish and shark in that large blue area that you can see up there. It has been very, very successful. There's only been one observed leatherback taken in that fishery since 2001. However, National Marine Fisheries Service, which is the federal fishery managers, are once again pushing to allow more swordfish fishing into this protected area at the risk of increased take for endangered leatherback sea turtles. This is part of an ongoing effort by the feds to expand the swordfish fishery here and in other places in the U.S. Pacific. This conflicts directly with the long history that the state of California has had in managing this high bycatch fishery, which dates back to the 70s. The fishermen mostly have to fish 75 miles or further offshore. There are many requirements and limits on the permits and when and where they can fish because of the damage that they do to the marine environment. Much of their fish is bycatch, is just tossed overboard. In 2010, we know that there were at least two sperm whales that were entangled and died in the fishery, and that would translate to as many as 16. So right now, this fishery is operating in violation of the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So I'm here today to ask the Ocean Protection Council to express its concern about the expansion of this fishery into the leatherback conservation area at the risk of taking more endangered species and protected animals. The Pacific Fisheries Management Council will be hearing specific proposals at their March 2013 meeting. And February, mid-February, is the deadline for comment. I realize that that might be a challenging deadline for the OPC, but any support that you can show and levels of concern about this process would be very helpful. The 2008 resolution that you passed in support of leatherbacks and opposing a new longline fishery has been very helpful in keeping that type of fishery out of our coast. The photos that you'll see right there are from a FOIA request to National Marine Fisheries Service on photos and videos from bycatching the fishery. And this is a megamouth shark, which is a very rare shark species, just to give you an idea of the type of damage that this fishery does. It's a dying fishery. Slowly but surely, we were hoping it was going to go away, but instead, the feds are trying to expand it. So that's a request, a letter, a resolution to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council from the Ocean Protection Council. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the council?
Thank you. I guess my question is process. I think it's pretty clear, based on the OPC resolution and the action of the legislature in the last several years, where the state is. Are there plans to monitor the recommendations of the Pacific Marine Fisheries Council to make sure that whatever they recommend is consistent with state law and, you know, the conservation goals of California with regard to this fishery, and that it's based on what we think is the best available science, et cetera? I mean, and I know that I know we can't take action today. I'm just wondering what kind of advice there might be going forward on this.
Well, my suggestion would be that we work with the executive director, ask her to take a look at this and report back to us at a future meeting, because I know that there's a concern about the potential for expanding here, but I'd like to know a little bit more about how... I'm sorry I said that. I obviously offended somebody's phone. My suggestion would be we ask you to, if you wouldn't mind, to have the executive director look into this, find out a little bit more about this, and report back to us at a future meeting. That sounds acceptable to you?
That's absolutely acceptable. And in the meantime, we would also will be monitoring to see if there is a recommendation that comes back to the Pacific Fisheries Council to expand the gillnet fishery or not. There may not be a proposal put forward, but we will know probably in January.
Okay, thank you very much. The next speaker, there are two more, Rio Williamson from Humboldt State, and then the speaker after that will be Richard Sadowski.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, council members, also staff, OPC staff, and participants. I'm Rhea Williamson. I'm the Dean of Research at Humboldt State University. And I'm here representing Humboldt State, the North Coast, rural communities that are isolated, that are dependent on the ocean and its resources. And I want to thank you for all the efforts on all of the topics that have been on the agenda today. It's been very, very interesting sitting here in my first OPC meeting. I hope you recognize that the actions that you're taking and the outcomes of those actions will affect my stakeholders, the young people coming out of high schools and into four-year colleges. HSU is one of 23 California state universities throughout California, from San Diego all the way up to the border with Oregon, where I am. I hope you will also recognize the importance of including students and academics from the CSUs and the UCs in much of what you're attempting to do. We have faculty working right now with the MPAs, with baseline data, with tsunami debris, with the impacts of pollutants on aquatic organisms. We have faculty working with wave energy. I'm sure that the woman mentioned earlier, if you're working with wave energy, you must also consider the turtles. So I just encourage you to continue what you're doing and think about the California State University in your efforts, involve the students, and keep protecting those oceans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then the final speaker will be Richard Sadowski.
Richard Sadowski, member of Coast Alliance, Citizens Opposing Acoustic Seismic Testing. Recently, the California Coastal Commission unanimously opposed the high-energy seismic survey that was proposed by PG&E for the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant regarding the seismic survey. However, for the last 3 years, PG&E has been doing an operation called low-energy seismic survey. There is evidence to suggest that they've been exceeding that low energy in the over 200 decibel range. This has anybody that's in marine biology has a detrimental effect on our marine life. And, you know, you can't say you have a marine protected area if you're blasting it with 200 decibels. Now, one of the things that one of the issues there was they got a permit. It was a 1984 permit, and it was rolled over on a negative mitigated deck to be able to do that. So there's some question on the validity of that permit to be able to do that. What I think the Ocean Protection Council needs to have a pulse on what's happening when it comes to any kind of seismic survey or oil exploration. Now, what the West Coast Governors Alliance recently signed with the MOU on ocean health, big issue is now tribal involvement. The Coast Alliance reached out to our friends in Hawaii. The Polynesian Kingdom of Atui is supportive of Coast. They're on Kauai. They were involved years ago in stopping the super ferry over an EIR issue in the birthing grounds of the whales. And the king is currently in New Zealand talking to the Maori people there, the indigenous people there, and trying to get a treaty together. I see the Ocean Protection Council, especially the California Ocean Protection Council, as a leader not only on the United States on a national internet, but on an international level, and needs to start incorporating the sovereign indigenous people, needs to bring in science, and needs to put it into practice, and hold people accountable, hold corporations accountable that violate the MPAs. Now, the World's Futures Council recently gave honorary mention to the California Ocean Protection Council for their MPA and marine spatial planning at the UN. And I'd like to congratulate the staff and the board on that. But we need to do better. And we need to move quickly. Sea level rise, climate change, these things are happening very quickly, and we need to address those issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There any further comment from the council or questions from the council? If not, I think we can adjourn. But I appreciate everybody in attendance today, and I appreciate your patience, and thank you very much.
Thank you.